Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Cold War Spy Stories from Eastern Europe. Edited by Valentina Glajar, Allison Lewis, and Karina L. Petrescu. Narrated by Krista Lewis and James Anderson Foster. Introduction. Allison Lewis, Valentina Glajar, and Karina L. Petrescu. If the Great War belonged to the soldier in the trenches, the Cold War surely belonged to the spy, the shadowy soldier on the invisible front fighting behind the scenes in the service of communism or the free world. During the Cold War, spy stories became popular on both sides of the Iron Curtain, capturing the imaginations of readers and filmgoers alike, as secret police outfits quietly went about their business of espionage and surveillance under the shroud of utmost secrecy. Curiously, in the post-Cold War period, there are no signs of this enthusiasm diminishing. Indeed, the advent of what is often called a post-political world order and a politics without frontiers has opened up exciting opportunities to tell these spy stories anew. We can now recompose these tales of collusion and complicity, betrayal and treason, right and wrong, good and evil, in light of new ways of thinking, as well as new evidence from declassified archival sources. We can read Cold War modes of storytelling differently, remaining attentive to the fictional subtexts in factual spy narratives and the factual underpinnings of fictional works about espionage. With the opening of the secret police archives in many countries in Eastern Europe, moreover, comes the unique chance to excavate forgotten accounts of espionage and tell them for the first time. Spy stories, told through the prism of the secret police, conveyed as file stories, about the top-secret lives of intelligence officers, their agents or informers, as well as their targets, represent one distinct mode of Cold War spy story, a mode based on factual or forensic truth, but undergirded by ideological fantasies and paranoid fictions. The opening of the files has also led to the rediscovery of curious or enigmatic espionage events, which are being told in interconnected multimodal webs of narration, whether as memoirs of notorious spymasters or as recent fictions and feature films about complex and hitherto unexplained Cold War incidents. Finally, the opening of the Iron Curtain has challenged old Cold War antagonisms such as the friend-foe binary, which is in turn recasting espionage scripts and the very character of the spy and double agent, as witnessed in new styles of spy films such as Bridge of Spies, 2015, and television dramas such as Weissensee, 2010 to the present, The Americans, 2013 to 2018, Deutschland 83, 2015 to the present, and Berlin Station, 2016 to the present, made for a global, post-political audience. This book is concerned with the stories we tell about lives lived during the Cold War. Stories are, according to Paul Ricoeur, what mediates between the past and the present, and a fundamental means of how we make sense of experience. The act of narrating is how we assimilate a life to a history. Put simply, without stories, lives would remain untold and hidden in dusty archives. While Ricoeur speaks here about the world of fiction as that which helps to make life, in the biological sense of the word, human, his analysis of the relation between stories and lives can be extended to all forms of storytelling, from the stories of history and personal memory to the stories in secret police files. Individuals seem entangled in stories that happen to them, according to Ricoeur, even historical individuals. And through their telling of stories, we can understand them. Narration, narratives, and plots are fundamental ways of making sense of the world. By means of the plot, goals, causes, and chance are brought together within the temporal unity of a whole and complete action. The Cold War stories in this book are complex amalgams of fact and fiction, history and imagination, past and present. They refer to the secret lives of spies, referring backward to the time of the Cold War, but like all texts in Ricoeur's hermeneutics, they also have a life beyond the historical time of writing. They come to life through the spectator who refigures the author's configurations against the backdrop of his or her own needs and understandings. Thus, these narratives narrated during the Cold War can be heard against the grain of a post-Cold War perspective. Above all, they can be heard with the hindsight that enables us to reassess many aspects of the Cold War and its facts and fictions about espionage. The Cold War. The joyous celebrations of victory over National Socialist Germany lay less than a year behind him when Sir Winston Churchill delivered his speech at Westminster College, Missouri, on March 5, 1946, and deplored the Iron Curtain that had descended on Europe and closed its eastern territories behind it. While his hope that the world would not see another world war came true, instead, a passive-aggressive confrontation between the former allies emerged and materialized into what has been called, poetically, the Cold War. When trying to explain this rapid deterioration of the Grand Alliance, historian John Lewis Gaddis points out that the Second World War had been won by a coalition whose principal members were already at war, ideologically and geopolitically, if not militarily, with one another. And this alliance's triumph had been possible because of the pursuit of compatible objectives by incompatible systems. Once the coalition reached its main common objective, National Socialist Germany's defeat, the victors had either to cease to be who they were or to give up much of what they had hoped to attain. As neither the Western Allies nor the Soviet Union were ready to renounce their principles, the coalition's division along ideological lines and Europe's ensuing division into two camps was imminent. Equally true was the fact that neither party wanted a new direct war, so the other available option was an indirect warfare, in which propaganda and operations carried out by or with the blessing of the two superpowers' secret services played a major role. According to Wolfgang Krieger, secret services were never as important for the national and international history of states as they were during the Cold War. They were no longer an extension to other instruments of power politics, but became a substitute for the war of the superpowers, which no one wanted to fight and which simply could not be fought, given the superpowers' growing nuclear arsenals. Carrying the laurels for the success of the war on the European Western Front, the United States approached the post-war era cautiously, not completely sure of the part it would play in Europe. That security in the homeland was a priority was undebatable, but how the United States would go about transplanting it to Europe was less certain. In breaking with its traditional isolationism during times of peace, the United States embraced its victor role and put forth a strategy that allowed it not only to restore peace to its European sphere of influence, but also to secure its post-war development. George F. Kennan formulated this strategy better than anyone else when he proclaimed that all that was needed from the United States when dealing with the Soviet Union was a long-term, patient but firm and vigilant containment of Russian expansive tendencies. The best way to achieve this was through closely monitoring and surveilling the enemy. The best place to do so was certainly Germany, where the United States and the Soviet Union faced each other not only along the country's inner border, but more intimately and directly along the inner city frontier of Berlin. Having carried the largest burden for the war in terms of human and material losses, the Soviet Union expected nothing less than goodwill from its former allies and compliance from its satellites to ensure peace in the world and its own prosperity. Relying on Marxism-Leninism, which taught him that sooner or later greed would make it impossible for capitalists to cooperate, Joseph Stalin counted on the inevitability of wars between capitalist countries to give him the upper hand internationally. Within his own sphere of influence, the Eastern Bloc, he made sure to install political leaders loyal to him, who thought to replicate his regime in their countries. Whether Walter Ulbricht in East Germany, Gheorghe Gheorghiu Dej in Romania, or Bolesław Bierut in Poland, the leaders of the three satellite states at the core of this project, they all embraced Stalinism and promoted it in their respective countries at great cost. To ensure their people's submission, the authorities in each of the three countries established powerful state police forces replicating the Soviet Czechist model. The secret services of both camps had to figure out a modus operandi for the times of peace, since they could not carry on with their previous practices. While in the United States and the Soviet Union the transition was more fluid, as the state leadership did not change as dramatically as it did in defeated Germany or satellite Romania and Poland, it nonetheless involved changes, even if they were primarily structural. Departments were renamed, integrated, or subordinated to other offices without really changing their duties. Collectively speaking, secret services are charged with identifying, containing, and disciplining or dealing with state enemies. The extent to which each secret service carries out these tasks, and the way it does, depend on the nature of the state they serve. During the Cold War, both the U.S. and the Soviet secret services also had to train the secret forces of their respective allies / satellites. The U.S. military helped establish the BND, Bundesnachrichtendienst, Federal Intelligence Service, and the KGB, Komitet Gosudarstvennoy Bezopasnosti, Committee for State Security, helped with the birth of the Stasi, Ministerium für Staatssicherheit, Ministry for State Security, the Securitate, Departamentul Securitati Statului, Department of State Security, and the UB, Uzad Bezpieczeństwa, Department of Security. While according to Krieger, the exact extent of American influence on the BND cannot be fully analyzed yet, insights into the Soviet method of forming the secret police forces of its allies are accessible in the archives of the respective forces. Ultimately, each secret police agency was charged with detecting activities of hostile powers and unmasking enemies of the state at home and threats abroad. Whatever the reason, once an individual attracted the secret police's attention, she or he entered a surveillance network of an interpersonal, political, and bureaucratic nature that reduced one to a target, a person of interest to the secret police and categorized according to enemy types. While these types varied from country to country, they were deemed equally dangerous in all the countries represented in this book. The Soviet Union was wary of the Zionist Jew, the old Russian elite, the wealthy peasant, kulak, the religious leader, and the dissident intellectual. In East Germany, the enemy bore the face of the West German spy and saboteur, the land-owning aristocrat, Junke, the cosmopolitan youngster with a preference for American culture, the deserter from the Republic, Republikflüchtling, and the critical or reform socialist writer or intellectual. Poland was equally at odds with the wealthy peasant and the Western spy and saboteur, but also with the meat black marketer, Fleischspekulant, the American instigator, the neo-Nazi, and the Jew as Zionist and revisionist. The Romanian state combated the intellectual and political opponent of the pre-war era, the religious leader, the land-owning peasant, and among its national minorities, particularly the ethnic German as nationalist, the Hungarian as irredentist, and the Jew as Zionist. Unmasking these troublemakers was essential to the secret police, whose agents and informants pursued their targets relentlessly. Cold War propaganda and covert operations. In the struggle between the two superpowers, propaganda was the main weapon of choice, deployed mercilessly by both sides. Propaganda was produced and reproduced across each of the two spheres of influence, from the dominant power down to its smallest ally or satellite state. For many years in the West, the Cold War was seen as a war of words. As Martin J. Medhurst writes, "A Cold War is, by definition, a rhetorical war. A war fought with words, speeches, pamphlets, public information or disinformation campaigns, slogans, gestures, symbolic actions, and the like. All these media could and did morph into propaganda. Propaganda was not something the West readily admitted to using, nor did it like to regard itself as participating in mutual struggles over ideology. Ideology was, after all, what the Soviets used, not the United States or its NATO partners. Yet propaganda was, as W. Scott Lucas has forcefully argued, rife on both sides, not just as an adjunct to policies, but as an integral part of a strategy to win hearts and minds, as well as acquire territory and attain economic supremacy." As research has shown, U.S. information officials had already launched the first peacetime propaganda offensive in 1945, and the United States' first two Cold War presidents used propaganda. As post-Cold War studies have increasingly concluded, propaganda was most definitely not the exclusive provenance of the Soviet Union and its satellites. Rather, both parties relied on it, openly and covertly. It infused political rhetoric and foreign policy, but more importantly, for our context, it underpinned mass culture, such as films, and to a lesser extent, literature. Critics of U.S. foreign policy during the Cold War have since drawn attention to its moralistic, ideological underpinnings and reminded us that it hid behind the pragmatic-sounding notion that it was merely serving the interests of national security. In the United States, the focus of Cold War information programs and their public diplomacy efforts was, as Laura Belmonte has argued, selling America to foreign audiences. Radio was central to these efforts, for example, and the United States' Foreign Intelligence Agency, the CIA, sought to spread democratic values behind the Iron Curtain through funding European radio services such as Radio Free Europe and Voice of America. the key to selling the West abroad was to explain its values and notions of freedom to the world. This was not only the task of espionage agencies such as the CIA, but also of NATO. Although NATO was primarily a military and political alliance, its cultural programs, such as the NATO Information Service, NATIS, provided crucial support for its operations through fostering mutual understanding and a sense of community. As a security community, NATO sought to extend beyond its geographical area and seek to influence neighboring countries to ensure political stability and good governance. While the Warsaw Pact did not have a similar tool of propaganda, it had, in effect, no need for one, since it fell to the common form to provide consistent, uniform propaganda across the Warsaw Pact. The common form, the Communist Information Bureau, was established in 1947 by the Soviet Union for the purpose of coordinating activities across communist parties around the world. Its first objective was to launch a propaganda peace offensive against the West. From 1960 on, NATO responded to attacks from the Soviet Union by openly declaring it would engage in psychological warfare, even in peacetime. Communist propaganda depicted the West as imperialistic and a plausible, real threat to national security, particularly in those satellite states close to the Cold War fault lines. According to NATO, this propaganda portrayed West Germany as a warmonger, a hotbed of Nazism, revanchism, and anti-Semitism. To the Soviet Union, NATO was a colonial and economic imperial organization that happily exploited West Germany's weakness as a divided country. In the United States and the West, anti-communist propaganda worked in a similar fashion and portrayed the West and its values as under threat from the Red Peril. These threats varied in type and scale from communists at home in the labor movement to the specter of a communist nuclear attack during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and later from Reagan's so-called evil empire in the 80s. The West's response to the Red Scare ranged accordingly over the course of the Cold War from McCarthyist inquisitions and religious crusades against communists to the purging of the teaching profession. On the other side of the Iron Curtain, the Soviet Union and its satellite regimes railed unrelentingly against the evils of Western imperialism and capitalism, invoking all the while the menace of a rebirth of Nazism and fascism. These putative evils posed a similarly wide range of threats to security from the various specters of invasion and war, which, during the Berlin blockade and the building of the Berlin Wall, was a genuine possibility, to the threat of a NATO nuclear strike in 1983. Although there was a remarkable degree of symmetry in these perceived threats, one area of propaganda warfare was asymmetrical. The one-way population movements from east to west. The West scored painful political victories over the Soviet Union in the continuous exodus of its populations from Eastern Europe, including ethnic Germans from Romania, Jews from Romania and the Soviet Union, and refugee dissidents and intellectuals from the counter-revolutionary flashpoints of Hungary in 1956, Czechoslovakia in 1968, and Poland in 1956, 1968, and 1981. Despite prevailing restrictions on migration provided by the Iron Curtain, the persistence of sizable numbers of political and economic migrants from east to west came at a considerable economic cost to the Eastern Bloc, which lost valuable labor power and human resources. In the case of dissident intellectuals and political refugees, there were damaging symbolic losses as well. East Germany suffered in particular from successive waves of emigration to the West, mostly before the closing of the borders and the erection of the Berlin Wall, when 3.5 million, or 1 in 6 East Germans, left or absconded from the German Democratic Republic, GDR. After the closing of the borders in 1961, the flow of refugees to the West continued, albeit radically reduced. Some fled in spectacular and often doomed escapes via hot air balloons, tunnels, hidden compartments in cars, and even airplane hijackings. There were in total 136 deaths at the Berlin Wall. 98 of the victims were shot dead. Other Eastern Bloc citizens left involuntarily and were forcibly sent into exile by their respective regimes, stripped of their citizenship, like Wolf Biermann in the GDR in 1976, and prominent Soviet dissident Petro Grigorenko in late 1977, or banished, as Andrei Sakharov, who was sent to Gorky in 1980 while under KGB surveillance. Dissidents and victims of the Gulag system who were allowed to travel to the West, such as Alexander Solzhenitsyn, Lev Kopolev, and Yefim Etkin, subsequently found themselves forced into exile, falling victim to standoffs between the superpowers that no diplomatic negotiations could ameliorate at the start of the Second Cold War in the early 80s. Cold War propaganda relied on the aforementioned national enemy types, which were upheld in strict binaries of enemy and friend that allowed for few shades of gray. Propaganda was an important way of making sense of the Cold War, and it suffused everyday life and culture, implicating everyone from those close to the center of power to those at the periphery. For the intelligence agencies at the epicenter of the Cold War, propaganda was, of course, part and parcel of a wide-ranging arsenal of instruments at the disposal of both democratic and totalitarian regimes. Intelligence agencies had recourse to far greater types of propaganda, including gray propaganda of questionable origin and accuracy, and even black propaganda, which is false information from a hostile source, parading as though it were from a friendly source. In addition to this gambit, intelligence availed itself of clandestine actions, or covert operations, which were an indispensable instrument in foreign policy and foreign intelligence agencies during the Cold War. In the early years, covert operations became important instruments on both sides of containment, justified by the rapidly deteriorating relations between the West and the Soviet bloc and the ideological cold nature of the Cold War. In fact, the 50s in particular were for the CIA a golden age for covert operations. In domestic intelligence, covert operations were also widespread during the Cold War, particularly in the Eastern Bloc. While secret operations on foreign soil generally enjoy a greater degree of acceptance, when used against a country's own citizens, there is far less tolerance for the secret tracking or surveillance of internal enemies. Yet both sides engaged in covert action against their own citizens and justified doing so by invoking counterintelligence or security arguments, namely that the domestic population was in danger from internal enemies or threats. On both sides of the Cold War, nation-states conducted covert operations against suspected communists in the West and anti-communists in the East. Secrecy was regarded as necessary for the success of a covert operation, even though there were risks, for example, that dysfunctional operations might not be detected in time, whether in democratic or authoritarian systems. There are, by the same token, obvious political advantages to secrecy. It enhances the power of the party using it, and where power sharing is called for, secrecy circumvents it. Propaganda.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?